This is an oral history interview for the Washington County History Museum with Patrick Green at Planar Systems on February 24th, 2012. We'll begin by just asking you to state your full name.
My name is Patrick J. Green.
And when were you born?
I was born April 12th, 1951, well into the last century.
And where were you born at?
I was born in Iowa City, Iowa. I lived there until I was 15, and my father was transferred with his business. We came to Portland, so I've lived in this area ever since.
When did you first become interested in science and technology?
When I was a little kid. I mean, I loved to go and go off. When I lived in Iowa, we always lived in towns, you'd call them. They were kind of the size of Eugene or Corvallis. But I'd go out and capture ants or bees or spiders and put them in jars and study them, and then most of the time let them go if they didn't die, but go out and get frogs and snakes and, you know, that sort of thing. And I always read about astronomy and whales and birds, and I don't know, it just always appealed to me to know about the natural world, and then also how things work. I try to take stuff apart, didn't always put it back together, but so I don't know where it came from exactly, but I just always like to know how things work and know about how to categorize stuff, and that holds true to the and build things. So I think that's a common trait among scientists and engineers. Most people start pretty early doing that sort of thing.
Where did you attend college?
Well, I was planning on going away to college, but due to some family constraints, I ended up going to Portland State, and I got a bachelor's degree in chemistry, and then I stayed and got a master's degree, and did some interesting research. My master's degree got 5 papers published and learned a lot.
And what was the field of science and technology like then?
Well, it's that's an interesting question. I used a slide rule, and there were the computers that I used were driven by cards, by, you know, cardboard punch cards, basically, and you loaded them in the morning and got your output in the afternoon on a long roll of paper. It was really clunky, just incredibly crude by today's standards. Nothing was digital, everything was paper-based, all the data taking was paper-based. But just two things come to mind related to this. When I was a graduate student in 1973, the first year I taught labs in chemistry for freshman labs, the first lab we always taught a slide rule drill. And one person had this little thing in their hand that they'd paid $150 for that would multiply, divide, add, subtract, and do square roots, a calculator. And that was kind of unique, and they didn't need to do the slide rule drill. Because slide rules, you had to learn how to use them. They're better than longhand on paper, but they're kind of clunky to use. The next year, in 1974, it was just the reverse. Calculators had gone below maybe $50, maybe $70. And just rather than learn and have to deal with how to do a slide rule, everybody but one person had a calculator. So it was just exactly the inverse of the prior year. And we all pretty much threw slide rules away. And the other thing that happened is another graduate student bought a Hewlett-Packard 35 calculator, which had an incredible capability. It could do logarithmic calculations, it could do all the trig functions, it could do exponentials, all the kind of stuff that you did on paper with logarithms, looking up the values in a piece, you know, in a book. And so calculations that were taking several hours, you could do in 15 minutes. And so this one guy, he was a veteran, so he had a little bit more money than the rest of us as graduate students. He had paid $400 for this HP 35, and I don't think he had it very much of the time. We all borrowed it. We would borrow it overnight to do stuff, and, you know, anyway, it was quite remarkable. And just one more thing. After I finished my graduate studies, I worked on an EPA grant at Portland State. And we were doing these calculations on these Hewlett-Packard handheld calculators, which were just wonderful. But when you had a lot of data, you had to enter in the keys, and there was no way to print stuff out. So Tektronix came up with a computer called the 4051 that was certainly one of the first desktop scientific computers, and it was one of the first desk computers, period, not even for scientific stuff. And it was just incredible, and it revolutionized what we were doing, taking data. And this was in the late 70s. I think we got this in about 77 or so. So, and then since then, it's just been a steady march of computer, you know, from having like one computer in the department to having everybody have a big clunky, you know, tower computer. And I remember when I had my first laptop and I was able to take stuff home and sit on my deck away from everything and do stuff on my laptop. And the other thing was, we always had admins, you know, at the time they were called secretaries, do most all the typing. You know, if you had to write a report, you would write it longhand and give it to the admin. And there were a lot more of these secretaries around that were just doing typing of reports and such. And of course, they were filed as paper. In the maybe late 80s, that started to go away. And pretty much we were all responsible for our own stuff, you know, writing our own reports. And in the early going, that was more difficult. Software was really not very streamlined. Then I got a Macintosh, actually, and that made it a lot easier. But there's, you know, it's right now the admins that we have, they don't do any of this kind of stuff to speak of. So, okay.
Yeah. So, were there a lot of computers at Portland State in your department in the 70s?
No.
No.
In fact, it's almost laughable. There was a calculator, a mechanical calculator, over in the math department, that if we had a bunch of calculations, we would go to use that prior to having these calculators. And I think it was in 74, thereabouts anyway, my wife bought me a scientific calculator similar to the HP, but it was from Texas Instruments, and it cost $150, and it would do all these same kind of calculations. And it pretty much became a requirement for all the graduate students and then later for students. And so everybody came, you know, that was just part of your school supplies in the mid-70s, is to go out and buy a calculator depending on, and the complexity was dependent on what the requirements you had. And that took the onus off of, you know, off of the university to some extent. But for doing big calculations, doing modeling and such, they still had mainframe computers. You know, they were had the footprint of a house, basically. They're just incredible by today's standards. And then they just started getting smaller. It was, you know, a real step forward when these powerful computers got to be the size of a refrigerator. Mm-hmm. But they would pale in comparison to my smartphone, you know, to my iPhone. But the compute power, what I could do with my iPhone would run rings around something that was, you know, the size of a refrigerator. It's just incredible. So,
do you remember when you got your first personal computer at home and what year that was?
Yeah, I bought a Macintosh for my family. That was, that's a good question. I built a single board computer. I'm not an electronics engineer, but I know how to solder, and so I had a friend that was selling these, and so I built a single board computer in 1979, and it wasn't very useful. I just play around with it. But we got an Apple computer in the early 80s at my house, and they were incredible. Yeah. And it became an expectation, I'd say, like I said, mid-80s to mid-80s, let's say, that every engineer had their own computer, and they were typically IBM computers, because the and But some people like Macs, and I like Macs at Tektronix. I had Macintosh, and they were completely incompatible at the time. Even if you had Word on the Macintosh, the application, Microsoft application, it wasn't compatible with Word on your PC. And if you had a Mac at home and a PC at work, I did at different times. The files that you did at home, you bring them into the other computer, they either didn't work or they had functions that didn't work. It was really annoying. So,
And so, if you were in grad school for chemistry, but and then you worked for Portland State on a grant. But when did you step into the job market? Did you know what your career objectives were?
I wanted to have a good job that was interesting. Seriously, I could have stayed on. I was working on EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, grant money, and I was being paid a reasonable salary, but it was not the sort of salary to prosper on. But it was great training. When Ronald Reagan was elected, what looked like he was going to be elected, I decided that there probably wouldn't be a lot more EPA funding, and so I better get a real job. So I applied to Intel and to Tektronix, and the short story is I got the first offer from Tektronix, and I started there in September of 1979.
Did you know a lot about Tektronix already?
I had a friend whose mother worked there. I knew some people who were working there. Not a lot, but I didn't know a lot, but it was clearly most everything that I heard was very positive. It was a progressive place to work, lots of good challenges. The people that started Tektronix were clearly people. Howard Vollum and Jack Murdoch were very concerned about the welfare of their employees, which wasn't a given, and certainly isn't a given today. It appeared that they were doing stuff that seemed like I could contribute to, and that fortunately turned out to be correct, or at least it appears to be 30 years later.
What was your first job there?
It's funny, most people don't think, why do you need chemistry for doing, I'm a display engineer, basically. I've been a display engineer my whole career. So why do you need chemistry? Well, the screens on cathode ray tubes, or the liquid crystal material that goes into liquid crystal, or the color filters or whatever, those don't just happen. It's typically a chemical process that's used to fabricate these things, and certainly a process, if not a chemical process. And you use materials that it's important to know the physical properties and toxicity and the working characteristics of them, and so a chemistry background is really useful in that. The first job I had was to be the screen process engineer for a full color CRT, which really sounds ancient right now, but we were trying to make a very bright, a very rugged cathode ray tube that could be used in an aircraft application. The project originally was going to be used for a tech instrument, but it turned out it was going to be too expensive, and we found some outside funding, a customer that was interested in this, to put these displays, to put a color digital display in aircraft. And so that took several years, but I had the opportunity to be the person that worked up a process for doing phosphor deposition, and there were some other patterning steps. It's called photolithography. I learned a whole bunch, and Tektronix was perfectly willing to support me in learning this. They had a great library to tap into what was the published literature. I went to conferences. There were an incredible number of experts in a wide range of technologies to learn from and to work with. It just hardly could have been a better situation. Just an incredible support structure, a very expensive support structure. So the products that Tektronix made were expensive to support all that, but it was a place that was unique in the world. So.
Did you work in other positions with Tektronix, or?
Yeah, I was. Yeah. I was a an engineer and an engineering manager and a product manager, project manager as well. So I went from kind of being only process-based to being more device-based. So I was the project manager and engineering manager for the development of some other devices. Some of them didn't make it into manufacturing, but they were all, you know, you call it on the R&D side. So, and again, some devices that were, there was a projection display that incorporated a liquid crystal cell into a cathode ray tube. Very high resolution. We showed incredible projected images in about 1989, that were way ahead of their time in terms of resolution. We worked with Eastman Kodak on this to some extent, but there was an economic downturn and the funding went away, and I went off to work on something else. So. But I've worked, in the bio I sent you, you know, I've worked on cathode ray tubes, on liquid crystal displays, on inkjet printer heads, on 3D displays, on touch panels, transparent displays, most recently, and incorporating LEDs into various devices. So it's all been actually a nice challenge and fun, stimulating. So,
well, while you were at Tektronix, though, what project did you work on that you were most excited about, or that you feel was your biggest contribution to that company?
Ooh, okay. Well, the one that made the most money to start with, from a financial standpoint, was this avionics color tube, as it turned out. And this, coincidentally, that business unit was later sold to Planar. And it made Planar a fair amount of money, and I think distinguished Planar for the, you know, these are high-performance displays. That's the kind of thing that Planar tries to sell now. Probably the most interesting project I worked on, and the one I was most proud in terms of the accomplishment, was this. It's called a liquid crystal light valve, this projection display that I described. It wasn't ever a product from Tektronix, but it had been an idea within Tech Labs that had sort of been languishing, and there were some real technical issues to make it work. And I was asked to put together a team to try this one more time. And we were successful in overcoming the technical problems. And we ended up showing full color images of a Blue Angels video in the one of the tech auditoriums on like a 15-foot screen, and it was great. They looked just spectacular, and there was nothing that was really available at the time that could do this simply, and it was just a matter of not being right from a business perspective for tech to productize it. There was another attempt to productize in the TV products group, and that didn't work out. So not everything works out, unfortunately.
Did you notice that a lot in the tech labs, like a lot of great ideas, but that they weren't able to market?
In particular, yes. In particular at Tektronix. When I first started there, there's a long story that I won't go into the details, but just before I started there in 79, they had developed a scanning electron microscope, which is a critical piece of equipment for doing a lot of what's now called nanotechnology. I mean, it was important for biological science, you know, to look at small biological structures, very, very fine resolution, also for integrated circuits. And they had developed a scanning electron microscope that had just incredible performance. but it got to a certain point in its development, and the project was killed. And so they had prototypes in Building 50 in the basically the R&D area where I was working, and we got a chance to use these things, even though they weren't products. And there were a number of things like that. And some of this is to be expected. I mean, you know, if you're a venture capital investor today, you might invest in, from what I understand, you know, in like 10 projects. And if one goes big and two are pretty good, you know, that's a pretty good track record. So, which is only, you know, nominally 30%. That's a good batting average, but it's not a very good success rate on a lot of fronts. So maybe some of this is to be expected, but it seemed like more of these projects could have been successful. But that's always the attitude of the engineers, you know. Or if you give me just a little bit more time, I can make it better. So that's always the case, and that continues. So we've had that situation at Planar as well. So
if you were at Tektronix in the 80s, you were there when Tektronix spun off, or when Planar spun off.
Yes. But I didn't spin off at the time. I knew the guys that were working in Building 50 as well. Chris King and Jim Hurd were the two senior managers, the executive managers that spun this off, and John Laney, who is also in this picture that I have in front of us here, and he still works at Planar, as it turns out. So I knew those guys, and I wasn't working on what they were working on. I was working on this avionics color display. But it was in 1994. I ran into Chris King at a conference, and I just mentioned to him that I had that the group I was working in at the time, we'd completed what we were doing. It wasn't moving on, and I was looking for a job. And he said, "Well, why don't you come and work at Planar?" So I did. So that was the transition.
And how did you find that company different from Tektronix?
Well, Planar's a lot smaller. Tektronix topped out at 24,000 people in 1984, and when I left, there were probably at least 15,000 still. Planar has never had more than 1,000 people, and so that was one big thing. We were working on pretty much one technology to start with, the electroluminescent display technology. The intent was to develop a full color version of that, and we came very close. And it's one of the most difficult things that I've worked on. We had a good group, a critical mass group. I think it's just proven to be very difficult, but it was. Like I say, we did good work. It was a fun project, but sometimes, and it's actually pretty rare, but this one just was not successful. So,
what were you hired to do then when you came to Planar?
To be mostly a project manager, an engineering manager, and the fact that I had a chemistry background helped because we were doing a lot of materials development, and I knew enough to be dangerous about the electronics and about the mechanical side of this stuff, so at least hopefully was competent to manage this, and I think that's been the case. And it just helped that I had a display background. So the interesting thing about working on displays that I really liked is that, you know, there's a materials background which caters to my chemistry education. But like I just said, there's a mechanical side to it, and you have to mount these displays, and there are design considerations you have to make in the mechanical design that are sometimes critical for their performance. There's an electronic and electrical side, there's an optical side, and even a human factor side. So you have to know something about human vision, because that's how you interact with these displays, and so you have to have some insight. So it's a very broad, kind of eclectic mix of expertise that, and hopefully insight that you have to work on displays. And there's really a focus on displays in the Portland metro area based on Tektronics need to have displays for their instruments, and so they invested heavily, and because of that, there are a lot of sort of unique display engineers in the area here, and that spawned a number of different companies and has been useful for other companies that have come here knowing that there were people with display expertise in the area. So Tektronics really, I'm one of the benefactors of this focus that Tektronics had.
As a manager, do you work with teams or manage teams, and how big are they here?
Yes, there's development teams, and they vary from just a few people to, we've had as many as 15, approaching 20 people on teams. Back when we were doing the color electroluminescent display development.
Do you feel like there's a lot of cooperation and innovation and sharing ideas?
Yeah, that's one of the great things about Tektronics, I thought, and certainly at Planar, is that a lot of selflessness, a lot of sharing, a lot of camaraderie, people interested in doing the right thing and moving forward, and, very rarely, if ever, a harsh word or hard feelings or mean-spiritedness. That was an important part of Tektronics. I mean, it was all about getting the job done and doing the right thing, and that's the case here. So, a lot of the spirit that came from Tektronics is found at Planar. And a real lack of inhibiting informality. Maybe that's a tortured phrase, but not much informality is what I'm trying to say, that would inhibit getting stuff done. So that's good for creativity. I mean, if you have an idea about something that is maybe not exactly what we're working on, and for example, if I had something like that, I feel completely free to go off and pursue that within reason. I mean, you don't want to run whatever you're working on off the track, but a lot of freedom, and that's great.
What was your first big project that you worked on with Planar?
Well, it was this color electroluminescent mm-hmm. display project, and again, there was a lot of interesting chemistry in the materials. We were trying to do something that was pretty difficult, given the fact that Leuca crystal display technology, which we weren't involved with at the time, was coming on fast. There had been a massive investment in Japan at the companies that with names that we would all recognize, Hitachi and Toshiba and Sony and Fujitsu, Sharp. They were all investing millions of dollars in the development of liquid crystal displays that could do color. And Planar had this electroluminescent display technology that was monochrome, and it worked fine, but people wanted to see color. We see the world in color, you want to depict that on your display. And it just turned out that from a materials perspective, it was very difficult to find materials in particular that would emit blue light. You need a material that emits in the green and the red and the blue to get a full color display. At least that's the simplest way to do it. And Mother Nature has just not been very forthcoming in providing a blue emitter. There was one clever engineer that came up with a way to do this with a certain material, but it didn't have all the characteristics that we needed. It was very close, but as they say, no cigar. So like I said earlier, that project was not successful. Since then, if I may, I've worked on a project. I was the product manager and project manager, engineering manager, for a stereoscopic 3D display. There's been a lot of interest in that of late, and we did this about 4 or 5 years ago, before it sort of became prominent again in the theaters. And that was a lot of fun. Again, it was very important to understand sort of human vision and the perception of three dimensions, to understand the characteristics of this display versus the one that we were developing versus other displays. And now that 3D is more of a, it's kind of a household world, household concept at this point, in that you can buy 3D displays at consumer electronics stores that you can bring into your home. The ones that we were selling were just more for professional use. But now Planer has other 3D displays that, you know, we kind of broke through with this first device. So I'm very, very happy with the way that's worked out. So,
do you have Planer products that you use in your home?
I have a Planer monitor, a desktop monitor. Most of what we sell, at least historically, has been, they're called embedded components. You know, this is what prompted Intel to put the little decal that says Intel inside. Otherwise, you never knew that they had, you had their processor. So I can recall taking one of my children to an emergency room, and there was some medical displays, some medical equipment that had our displays in it. And I could tell they were our displays. And I talked to one of the nurses, and the good news is my daughter wasn't serious going to the emergency room. But I was talking to one of the nurses, and I mentioned that, you know, I work for the company that makes those displays. And she said to me that when I see those, you know, those yellow displays, that's the color of the monochrome electroluminescence, that's a medical display to me. I know that that's, you know, that's a reliable product. And even though, you know, there's the box and all the rest of the electronics, the thing that you look at was the Planer display on that. And this woman, this nurse, she identified a medical display with the color of the electroluminescent display that Planer produced. So that isn't a home thing, but it's certainly something that's that you can identify. Now, more recently, we sell these monitors that, like I said, I have one at home, and it's fun to walk around. There's a hardware store about 4 miles from here, 3 miles from here on 185th and TV Highway. At the checkout stand, they have Planer monitors, and they didn't even know that, you know, we were here, just in proximity to where they're located. So.
Well, and Planer is involved in so many different areas of business, and also globally.
Sure.
Have you traveled at all?
I've traveled a fair amount, and I really appreciate the fact that I've been able to. I've gone to Japan and Taiwan and a bunch of places in Europe. We have a manufacturing facility in Finland. So last winter, in January, I was thinking this might have been ill-advised to go to Finland in January, and it was kind of interesting, actually. They had already had they were past the time in December where they had a minimum amount of light during the day. I think they have like 4 hours of daylight in December. It really gets people down. And when I was there in late January, I think it finally got to be light during the day at about 11 o'clock, and it was pretty dark at 4. But Helsinki, we have a facility outside of Helsinki, is a wonderful place, and the Finns are great. It was very enjoyable. And I've been to conferences, like I say, in Japan and Taiwan and in Germany and in England and Scotland, and not always, but sometimes have an opportunity to stay and, you know, stay an extra day or something. But most of the time it's, you know, you go there and you come back. So, but it's very nice to do this overseas travel. And I've been able to travel not to every state in the country, but probably, you know, more than 30 states in the country, all over the United States and some in Canada, on various business. So, yeah, fair amount of travel.
And then being located here in Oregon, do you find that you do feel a lot of competition with a lot of the global or Japanese technology firms?
Yeah, and more all the time. The Japanese in particular identified display technology as something that they wanted to target and develop as develop a competency and develop products in the 1980s, starting with color picture tubes. And that was in the 70s, actually. They bought patent rights from various American companies to do that. But the interesting thing is that it's gone from the sort of focus or the center of development for display technology has gone from Japan to Korea to Taiwan, and now is in mainland China. And Japan is having a real struggle with their display manufacturing because it's very expensive and it requires incredible amounts of investment for the manufacturing facilities. You know, I never would have guessed that in 2012 that a 55-inch diagonal, I mean, we're sitting in a conference room with a 55-inch diagonal monitor, but you can go to Fred Meyer or any consumer electronics store and buy a TV of that size for less than $1,000. That would be unheard of. That would have been, if you would have told me or any display engineer in the 90s that was going to happen, it would have been science fiction. I mean, there was still talk about how are we going to have hang-on-the-wall TVs then. So it's just incredible how much has been invested and the progress that's been made. And I don't know where it's going to go from here. It's incredible. You don't really need displays a whole lot bigger than that. It'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, I think what will happen, actually, to answer my own questions, they'll be incorporated into walls and they'll be even more ubiquitous. And we're working on stuff sort of like that, actually. I showed you the transparent display downstairs. And anyway, it just continues to be very exciting to work on display technology. I hope I answered your question.
And so what does your work week look like here?
I really like the way my work week is structured. I don't have a whole lot of onerous meetings that I need to go to. Again, being in an R&D position, I get to work on the fun stuff, you know, which is really, I feel very lucky to do that. But I get here in the morning at 8:30 or so, and usually get to define my own day and get to assist in defining what some other people do as well that I work with. We typically have specific goals for the day, the week, and, you know, longer term in mind in the development of certain devices, targeting, say, a showing to a customer or a trade show. And so we have to figure out, okay, so what do we have to do to make this work, to make to create a device that is presentable? And if we're further along in the development, you know, how do we transition this to manufacturing? Where are the issues that keep this from being manufacturable? So the day is usually spent in some meetings or in a lab or working at a computer, you know, looking for information or whatever, you know, contacts on the internet, meeting with vendors. Every week we probably meet with at least two or three different vendors of products that will assist us in doing what we do. And then there's some amount of time that's spent reporting on, you know, progress. And again, the good news is that isn't an onerous part, but it's real important to do that. And we have a meeting every Monday in this room, actually, where we kind of review what we did, a small team of people, kind of review the progress we made in the last week and talk about what we're going to do in the coming week. And I've been in those meetings before where they were huge and, you know, you went around the table and it got pretty boring and it was pretty much a waste of time. But we have a pretty productive, constructive approach to this. And so it's really, oh yeah, we get, you know, let's talk more about that data and, you know, what does that really mean? What should we do to try and figure out what that really means, or what should we do next as a result of learning that? And then almost every day I go someplace to have lunch, just to clear my head. There's places within walking distance, and several days a week I have lunch with people either that work here at Planar or work someplace else. I try and network just at least once every couple of weeks to have lunch with somebody I haven't had lunch with for a while, just to keep up with what's going on. It's important to do that. And then every Sunday morning I write a weekly report. So I don't know why it's worked out to be Sunday morning, but I spend about an hour and I write usually a one-page summary of what I've done in the last week and what I plan to do in the coming week. And that's the basis for this Monday meeting I was telling you about. And then I send that out to a bunch of people so they can keep track of, they can have input on, you know, say, oh, we really need that, or, you know, no, you know, the need for that has kind of gone away. And one of the other interesting things that I really appreciate is I rarely am just working on one thing, so I get a chance to kind of diversify. So I feel like I'm a real lucky guy.
How do you get new ideas? I know you said you attend conferences and you have a lot of people that you work with that are probably inspiring too, but...
That's a great question and a tough question to answer simply. So this transparent display, which is probably it is the most recent thing we're working on, and it's an innovative kind of eye-catching device that we hope will be an important product moving forward. It's a combination of seeing something sort of similar at a trade show, and also just the way we were. It's complicated I don't think I want to go into the gory detail of exactly the similarity, but we were working on another project where what amounts to the transparency of the LCD was a problem. And we were noticing that, you know, under the right conditions, when you drive the display to white content, we could see through to the backside of the display, and we're seeing some things that we didn't want people to see. It was distracting away from the content on the screen. Well, as it turns out, what we did to fix that problem, or to address it anyway, was real important for this display. So if we hadn't done that other project and hadn't got this kind of seed of an idea, we'd be much less further along. So actually, we were able to turn around a first kind of proof of concept device in a matter of a couple of weeks. And so two big elements are, you know, the germ of the idea, which sometimes it comes in the shower, sometimes you hear about it from somebody else, or, you know, somebody else has a good idea, and then you just jump on that. But the thing that makes that happen almost always is that you've done your homework in some other supporting way. So we've done a lot of work on light emitting diodes, for example. And it turns out that for this particular device, the illumination is really important. And so we had a bunch of these. We had done a lot of work. We knew about efficient LEDs that were appropriate for this application. So it's the old, you know, Abraham Lincoln said that chance favors the prepared mind. So just in the kind of stuff that I'm doing and my near colleagues are doing, it just helps to sort of be prepared and think broadly and kind of learn about, I call it a bag of tricks. So it's important to try and replenish your bag of tricks or stock it as much as possible, because it really helps to, sometimes you have ideas that are just, you know, stupid or, you know, they sound great for a little while and then you realize that, no, that's really dumb. But sometimes the key part of an idea is, of making it feasible, is to be able to respond from your bag of tricks. And it's just a chance thing that you happen to learn about or hear from a vendor about or whatever. So you have to be kind of a sponge. Those are two of my favorite lines about bag of tricks and be a sponge. When we have interns and young engineers, I always tell them to be a sponge and to enhance your bag of tricks. So
what factors do you think have contributed to your success in your line of work?
I think the last thing that I was just talking about has been important. A lot of being creative in general, and especially in engineering or in science, is about analogy and keeping track of a broad scope of things. That wasn't eloquently put, but you get my a range of knowledge is useful. And it's pretty incredible sometimes how a small thing from an experience 10 years ago might be useful in assisting you with moving forward with a good idea. So I try to be broad. I'm trained as a chemist, but I don't do much pure chemistry anymore. And frankly, I'm happy with that because I enjoy doing this, you know, being involved with this other stuff and working with people that have expertise in a broad range here. So I think you ask how I've been successful. It's just that I think I work well with people, and I keep my eyes open and try and be an effective problem solver, which at the core of most all that I do at this point, it's problem solving. Part of it is understanding what the problem is to start with. So.
Now, how about the patents? You have 5 patents that you hold.
Yeah, next I have. I that was in the bio I sent you. I think, and there's going to be some more here. It's interesting. I was involved with some work that was innately patentable at Tektronix. That, on some of it was chosen to be a trade secret. It's expensive to file for a patent. And so, you know, you can have an idea and you can prepare a disclosure, and unless there's an obvious business benefit, often patents aren't pursued. And now it takes like 4 years to get a patent. It's really this is a huge problem. But yeah, I've been involved. There was a patent for this color tube, and. We've got some stuff that's patentable more recently here as well. So. But most of the time, frankly, a fair amount of what we do is treated kind of the equivalent of a trade secret, which is something that if you do this formally, you write it up and then you put it on file, but you don't share it. And at least there's a formality there that if someone else patents something, you can say that you had prior art. Now, there's been some changes in the law that is not as effective, but anyway.
Interesting. And your bio also said that you do some writing that you publish in science journals?
That's kind of an alternative to some things. If it's more data related, or it depends here, you write a scientific paper. And so starting back with my thesis, I think there were 5 papers that were published when I was doing fluorine chemistry. And then on the EPA grant, there were, I sort of lost track of these, but 4 or 5 papers that we published on, it was air pollution chemistry. And most of the projects I've worked on at Tech and here, there's some opportunity to publish something if you want. And working in industry is a lot different than working in an academic setting. In an academic setting, this is one of the signs that you're being productive, is to publish a paper. In an industrial setting, it can be, but on the other hand, you don't want to publish critical information that would share leverage with your competitors. So there's a fine line about being careful what you publish. Sometimes a paper that's published is not really so much scientific, but you're just kind of declaring that, hey, here's a new product, or here's a new feature in a product. And it's almost like advertising. That isn't as pure from a scientific standpoint. And it's not very satisfying sometimes. But it gives you a chance to illustrate what you've been doing, and, you know, to talk about your work, which everybody likes to do that. That's what you're giving me a chance to do right now. So
how about, without disclosing any company secrets, what are you working on next, or well, what are you excited about?
The thing I showed you downstairs, the next thing is probably this transparent display, and I can talk about that because we've been showing it at trade shows, and it makes use of some characteristics of liquid crystal displays that most people don't know about. And as I mentioned earlier, we've been working on LEDs, and liquid crystal displays don't emit light, so you have to illuminate them in some way. And we have some experience and some knowledge on how to do that. There are some other optical characteristics of liquid crystal displays that we think we know how to optimize to make them look better as a see-through display, or view-through is the trademark that's going to be used for these products. And so this caters nicely to some expertise that we have, and I've been trying to drive this just because it looks like it's fun. Most everybody that we show it to, there's a gee-whiz aspect to it. And actually, that stereo display that I talked about a while earlier, that had the same effect. I mean, people would, it has a very interesting effect. I don't know if you've been to a 3D movie or seen, I mean, it's a unique, it gives you a unique perspective to see things in 3D, both literally and figuratively. So
from your time here at Planar, what product that you've worked on do you feel is your most significant contribution?
Oh, probably that stereo display. Frankly, before that, I worked on a number of projects that were a lot of fun, and we did some good work, but they didn't make it as products, which is, like I was saying earlier, is not an uncommon thing, but it's a pretty frustrating thing. We worked on one project, and unfortunately I can't talk about it in detail, but it was a touch panel technology that was just extraordinary. And I was not the originator of the idea. The two engineers that were working for me at the time came up with this really clever idea. And it was the sort of thing where the concept, once we implemented it, was very close to being product worthy, but it had a couple of flaws, a couple of issues that we were having trouble figuring out. And like I said earlier, you know, engineer always wants to have more time to try and figure things out. And the CEO at the time decided that he didn't want to finish working on this. But we had several patents, some of the patents that I was talking about earlier were related to this project. And we were kind of disappointed, but as it turns out, we benefited from this later on. And I probably shouldn't say any more than that.
Yeah, but so. You do find, like, even if you kind of have a little bit of a failure, you can learn from it and possibly use.
And we
that
published two papers
later.
Out of this, for
okay.
example, and so there's some record of this. And we went to these trade shows and we had prototypes. And frankly, I think there was general agreement that this was a worthy effort, a worthy technology to work on. But, you know, you really like to make money for the company on these things. And, I mean, that's why we're here. And that's the added sort of objective that's not, you don't have in an academic situation, you know. That a paper is pretty much an end in itself in an academic situation. You want everybody to read it and stimulate thought and discussion and all that, but you know, obviously universities aren't trying to make money. That's why we're here at Planar, is to be a profitable company. So we want to contribute to that.
Well, I guess we'll transition kind of to talking more about the company and its success and how. It's just location here in Washington County. How do you think that's affected its success, or maybe been detrimental in a way?
Yeah, I think it's been a positive thing. And like I mentioned earlier, since Planar is a display company, the fact that Tektronix sort of set the stage here with a focus on displays, there's a lot of people in the local area that can be tapped into. Either as, you know, to hire as employees or as consultants that have display experience. So having that expertise in this area has been a big plus. I mean, going back, just not that I'm just as me as an example. Let's say Chris King, the chief technology officer, he didn't have to go off and recruit me. I mean, I just drive to a different location now instead of Tektronix, I drive to Planar. And it's very handy to be able to do that. Now, this is why you have recruiters and headhunters or whatever to find people throughout the world. to find the right expertise. But I think there really is an advantage to having a sort of a center of excellence of display technology in the area.
Since you've lived here since you were younger, you've seen that the concentration of the tech firms grow here a lot.
It's incredible. Yeah. When Hewlett-Packard moved up here in the 70s from the Bay Area and moved to, you know, put their facilities in Corvallis, and when Intel started building here, and all the companies that had been spawned from Intel and from Tektronix, so that now, this is now called the Silicon Forest, you know. Tektronix was pretty much isolated when they started Tektronix in the 1940s, you know, right after World War II. Howard Vollum was a radar engineer. And that was one of the reasons why they developed all this expertise from the ground up, because they were so far away from everything else that it was a lot easier to have their own electronics expertise, and they developed their own CRT capability and all the rest. So now that's, from a business perspective, that's kind of frowned on, but that's what's happening now. That's what was happening then. Mm-hmm. So.
When do you think you heard that term first, Silicon Forest?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure. Probably in the 90s. There was a book that came out about then. So I honestly don't remember for sure. And then there's these two posters that were done by an MBA student, I think, at PSU. I have both of them. I have one, the more recent one, up in my office. It's great. So. Mm-hmm.
How do you think this area, the Silicon Forest, differs from Silicon Valley?
I think it's a little more laid back. That's both a good and a bad thing to some extent. I've been to the Bay Area, the San Jose area, a bunch of times, and gotten some sense. I know a bunch of people that have worked there and worked down there. I think it's much more intense. That's a good question. Much more diversified in the focus of technology, and probably certainly more diversely successful. One big difference, and this is maybe a too much of a gory detail, but I've always wondered about this. In the Bay Area there, they have some incredible universities. They have Stanford and Berkeley, and smaller UC branches have developed in the area. There's nothing, and they are integrally, intimately, let's say, involved with the technology development. In the Portland area, there isn't anything like that. Portland State, I've always wondered, I mean, Portland State has really not been a big player in technology development. And neither is Oregon State historically, or University of Oregon. And of course, they're geographically removed, not by much, but you know, Berkeley and Stanford are right in there. Palo Alto is just, you know, the northern end of the Silicon Valley. And I think that's had something to do with it. And I've talked to, you know, after I was doing what I was doing at Tektronix, I went back to the chemistry department at PSU and mentioned this, you know, and just said, why? Because there was no involvement with Intel, for example, and they do a lot of chemical processing. That's what I would have done if I would have gone to and worked at Intel. And to my, well, I'm confident that no huge effort has happened. So there's one big difference that's I think has limited the growth in the Silicon Forest, because you get a lot of good ideas, or at least the core of ideas, from universities and from the graduate students that come from them. So, and we've hired a lot of Oregon State people, for example. We have an intern program. I just don't think it's of the magnitude of what's happened in the Silicon Valley. So I'm no expert on this, but that's my feeling.
Would you say, too, with both companies, a lot of your colleagues are just from other areas, and or are you kind of unique that you're from the Portland area, basically?
No, not really. Right. I mean, I'm thinking of people that I work with. I can think of several that went to school around here, at least to high school, and maybe they went away to school and came back. I'm not sure I have a percentage. It wouldn't be far from half, though, I'll bet, if I, you know, if I really thought about it. And people, what I hear from recruiters is that it's hard to get people to move away from here. The good thing about Silicon Valley is that there are, you know, there's all, it's this center of expertise and excellence and business and great ideas. But I went back down there a couple of years ago, I remember, and was looking at a newspaper, and they were touting the fact that you could get into a house for $3,500 a month for your house payment. You know, and just little fixer-uppers were going for $500,000. So that's pretty crazy. And that's one of the quality of life things around here is, you know, and houses got more expensive and they've come down a little bit more most recently. But that was one of the reasons why Intel and HP and others have wanted to relocate here, is that people could afford what they were doing. And of course, there's all the great things to do outside of work. Mm-hmm. So,
well, have you noticed too that the high tech firms have really helped this local economy a lot?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to not find people, families that people didn't work at Tektronix, and you know, even this friend of mine from high school, his mother was, the term is, she was an operator, which means an assembly line kind of person. Not a degreed person, not an engineer, not a technical job, but she made a living wage job. She had a living wage job. She made a living wage at it and got full benefits and all the rest here. Tektronix doesn't have those kinds of jobs to speak of now. I mean, they, with the outsourcing and with the, I'll call it streamlining that Danaher has done in obtaining, in, of acquiring Tektronix, they just don't have many of those kinds of jobs anymore. And that's a real benefit for the economy. Not to mention the fact that, you know, engineers are paid pretty well, and that's a real boost for the economy as well.
Another question too: have you, throughout your career, noticed that maybe more women have been involved in technology too?
That's a great question, and some, but not enough, frankly. I have a granddaughter, and I'm trying to. She and her brother were at my house over the weekend, and we did science experiments. So, there aren't that many women. Certainly not in engineering. The company that we acquired, Clarity, had a woman who was the VP of marketing. But it's just not, my experience has been not so much, no. I mean, I can count the number of women managers and engineers that I've worked closely with on my hands, the fingers of my two hands, I think, unfortunately. So, not a good thing. I think it's getting better, but I mean, I don't sense that there's any bias. It just when we get applications, they're typically men.
Mm-hmm. How about the diversity in general? Washington County's demographics are apparently the most diverse in Oregon. Have you noticed that that's changed over time a lot?
No, I wouldn't say that.
No.
And you know, diversity in terms of African American employees at Tech or at Planar, some but not a large number. Hispanic folks, certainly there more recently, yes, a lot more Hispanic people, and Asian people, people in particular from China, probably more recently, but. A lot of folks, I mean, I've worked with a fair number of mostly Chinese, some Japanese and Korean engineers as well. So, and of course we deal a lot with folks in the Far East, and Planar has an office in Taipei and in Shanghai, so. And Tektronix had a facility, a joint venture called Sony Tech, that was in Tokyo. So, but you look around at the engineers, for better or worse, they're mostly white males.
Mm-hmm. So. And then, with your companies, do they have any interest in helping, like, the local community, doing philanthropy or contributing
that
way?
Yeah, that's a good question. Tech did a lot more of that, and there were clubs that did that.
Mm-hmm.
There's some at Planar. A group of us just went to the Oregon Food Bank a couple of weekends ago and spent an afternoon, and that's something that happens on a regular basis. There isn't a great deal of that, but some, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's what I find is it's mostly, you know, it's driven by more of an individual kind of thing, and right now it's just not a focus for mm-hmm. Planar senior management.
And you mentioned you like to network a little bit.
Yeah.
Do you feel like the companies are competitive here, or do a lot of people kind of cooperate together and know each other?
No, I mean, mostly cooperation.
Yeah.
I mean, see, I think that the feeling is you don't want to burn any bridges,
mm-hmm.
On the one hand, but there isn't a tremendous amount that is truly top secret proprietary. There's some. But I think, I mean, at least my attitude, I think this is shared, is that, you know, you have this feeling that, hey, I got a problem today and could you help me a little bit? Maybe you'll have a problem. And it's kind of like that thing I was referring to earlier when you were asking about creativity. Sometimes it's really useful to hear about somebody else's problem because you may have that problem later, or maybe if you have a solution for it, that's a business opportunity. So it really is to your benefit to at least be open-minded about it. I have worked with some people that just don't like to share anything. And frankly, they've not been successful, widely successful. I mean, maybe momentarily or whatever. But.
Okay. Well, I think we'll probably conclude now.
Okay.
It's been great to hear you talk about your history with your companies and your career. Thank you for being able to do this oral history.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Melanie. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope it works out here. And do like 30 seconds, okay? So one of the things that I think gets taken for granted in small companies, or certainly startups, is you hear about startups all the time. And I don't know the exact percentage, but I wouldn't be surprised that 95% of them fail. And Planar was started based on this electroluminescent display technology that a number of other companies tried to develop and incorporate into products. And not very many were successful. There were only like two or three. So Planar had kind of this double whammy against it to start. Very difficult technology, and it's a startup. And my belief is that the reason that Planar started was successful, or has been successful, and certainly was successful in getting started, what I'm trying to say, is because of Jim Hurd and Chris King, who had this sort of like NASA back in the Apollo program, that failure was not an option. But it wasn't that they were nasty about it. It was a positive thing. And I wasn't around in the first decade of Planar, first 11 years or so. And there were some really ugly times, some very difficult times. But Jim Hurd, who's the now deceased founding CEO, he was just the greatest guy. I mean, he would, when we were doing this color EL work, he used to jog at lunchtime, and he would come and sit on my desk and ask about how we were doing. Now, here's this 6'2", sweaty guy sitting on my desk, but it wasn't a bad thing. I mean, it was an honor to have him come and ask, and he, obviously this was important, and there was an urgency to do this. But I didn't get that kind of sense. I mean, he was inspiring. And frankly, that's a tough quality for CEOs, in particular, in general, let's say, senior managers. And he and Chris and some of the other folks that were that started the company, it was just the fact that, oh, this is going to work. We're going to make this work. And it was very difficult. And I think that's what makes all the difference here. And on top of that, they retained their humanity, which is another thing that doesn't happen very often. That's what I wanted to say. So anyway, he got leukemia. It was really sad, and died relatively suddenly. Mm-hmm. Chris stayed at Planer until about 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And like I said, I think he's going to be interviewed for this too. He has a good sense of the early history, and he's tried to write some of this, and I think he'll be an interesting interview. So, anyway.